Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accomplishing social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our human potential for creating more healthy and humane places to live. I'm so pleased to welcome Allison Hewitt as my guest on Making Change. Allison is the Senior Fellow in Social Innovation at MARS, a Canadian organization whose mission is to drive Canada's social and economic prosperity by bringing together the nation's science, technology, and social innovation sectors in a creative spirit of discovery and exploration. As Director of the Social Innovation Generator at MARS, Allison is in charge of advising social entrepreneurs, building the social innovation ecosystem, and incubating successful programs such as the MARS Center for Impact Investing and the MARS Solutions Lab. Prior to joining SIG at MARS, Allison has been an executive director at several organizations at both the local and national level, including Community Information Toronto, where she led the development and implementation of Canada's 211 system, both in Toronto and nationally. Given the breadth of experience that Allison brings to the work of generating social innovation to create the future of our world, it's my pleasure to have Allison Hewitt share her observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Allison Hewitt. Welcome, Allison.
Hey, Hildy.
I am just so glad that you could be with us today.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Could you tell our listeners, to just get started here, a little bit about you? I've had such a fascinating journey of your life that has brought you to the point where you're at. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that meandering path that has brought you to where you are?
Sure, I'd be pleased to. Thank you. So I was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and my parents brought me here to get away from the troubles, in quotes. And I've always felt like a very lucky kid to land in Canada. I'm also the eldest, and I have two younger brothers. So that really, I think, set up my life path to be a bossy boots, as they lovingly call me. And I really got interested in social purpose work when my home economics teacher asked me if I would come in and do a breakfast club with her. This was a long time ago, before there were regular set up breakfast clubs. And I came in at 7:30 in the morning to help kids in my community who didn't have breakfast. I didn't even know such a thing existed. And we didn't have any money, so we gave them horrible white bread and cheese with sandwiches, but it was something for these kids to eat. And at 12 years old, I figured out my life path based on this wonderful home economics teacher who was trying to help other people. So that's how I got interested in it.
I studied
things like criminology. I studied law, public affairs, voluntary sector management, and most recently, organizational development with a focus on leading change. And then I worked in, when I was studying law, this was the time when they were changing the law in Canada from rape to sexual assault. And so I volunteered at a rape crisis center. And what became clear to me was that I could study all I wanted, but by telling a woman it wasn't her fault, I could fundamentally change a life.
Wow.
And at that point in time, I stayed in the nonprofit sector. I worked at shelters for homeless women. I ran the first suburban youth shelter here in Toronto, where we set up a task force of youth that ran as a shadow cabinet to the city council. And for 10 years, I ran an organization called Community Information Toronto, where I launched the Canadian version of 211, which is 3-digit access to human service information. That was, in fact, my social innovation, and really proud to say that it's now available across the country. So that was a terrific experience.
Wow.
Yeah, and while there, I had two children, which is why I stayed for 10 years, which felt like a very long time for me, and lost a child. In the course of losing a child to cancer, I ended up spending a lot of time at SickKids. And when I felt I was done with the 211 stuff, I ended up getting a job at SickKids, not as an oncologist, way too old for that, but really as an advocate for kids, and ran a national child advocacy program focusing on child safety. Did that for about 5 years, and then ended up at MARS, an interesting innovation center where I was tasked with running the social innovation programs here.
Tell us a little bit about what it means to run the social innovation programs there. What exactly is that?
So Mars is a really interesting place, sort of like Nesta. And I know you've spoken to Jeff Mulligan, where we started off commercializing research. Canadians are brilliant researchers, not so good at the commercialization process. So we worked in the areas of life sciences, technologies, clean tech. And then some folks from the McConnell Family Foundation, Canada's largest family foundation, approached Mars about joining this really interesting network they were setting up called SIG, Social Innovation Generation. It would include Mars. It would include an academic partner, the University of Waterloo, led by Francis Wesley. It would include a practitioner called Alec Mansky out west in British Columbia. And then the foundation and Mars would round it out of four nodes across the country to create a culture of continuous social innovation in Canada. So these were folks who were thinking really deeply about how do we understand social innovation, and then how do we create this culture that will enable it to continue. So this is about the sixth year of that initiative, and it's been very, very interesting. Thinking about how do I work within an existing innovation center, i.e. focused on mainstream innovation, to ensure that social innovation is represented so that ventures can look at their initiatives both through an economic and social impact lens. It's been a fascinating journey.
Wow. Wow. Well, I can't wait to hear your answer to as we start moving along in the question that I start all of these interviews with, which is in all of that path, and you have had such a varied patchwork of experiences, when you see change happening, what are the ingredients that you see creating change? What do you see undergirding that change?
Thank you for asking this question for many reasons. Many of us in the social change movement are so busy looking down and doing, we don't actually stop and reflect on this. So thank you for giving me the chance to do that, and also for encouraging me to listen to other podcasts because they were brilliant and I learned so much.
Oh, good.
But when I see this, I actually see things popping up. For example, I love this concept of a visionary leader that has a real sense of what the future could look like, but that they have the ability to then communicate that in such a way that they engage others. We didn't always have the language of social entrepreneur. In fact, it's relatively new. But I love that there was someone who could see things differently. And then that's where it stops. I'm not about the hero worship, like many of your other guests have talked about. I'm very much about the individual who can look at things a bit differently and then begin to engage others or begin to put things together in new ways that engages others. I see those people. I see the breaking down of silos and convening and getting beyond egos. And I love this role of the knowledge broker, the person who pulls together different thinkers to tackle complex challenges and think about things differently.
Tell me more. I'd love to know stories, examples of what you've seen.
So we've recently been experimenting here at Mars with the concept of a solutions lab. And what we've done is we went to the province of Ontario and we said to them, give us a complex challenge, not a communications challenge, which is where people often default, but a complex challenge you're dealing with. It had to be something you've tried before, but you're stuck. You need to think about, can this particular problem benefit from multi-sectoral engagement in a neutral space with an end user who's going to be an ultimate beneficiary? And then the most challenging thing was you super smart people can't already know the answer to this problem. That was really the hardest thing because they've done all this work in policy. They've been thinking about things. And by phrasing it that way, they were then put in a position where they could be vulnerable. And that's going to be one of my themes. I think change makers allow themselves to be vulnerable. They don't pretend that they've got the answer. They reach out into other sectors and have them define the problem differently, think about engaging others and how to look at things differently, and ultimately coming up with new solutions for things like chronic disease prevention, social housing, support for persons with disabilities. Those are some of the issues that we're working on right now.
Wow. So with the Solutions Lab, as you went out and asked folks, what kinds of things did they come up with and where did you go with that?
So what we did was we had a global search for a super smarticle person who could begin to tackle this. And we found a guy called Yuri van den Steenhoven, who is from the Netherlands. And Yuri had been running a program called Kennisland for about 9 years, or Knowledge Land, in Amsterdam. And he'd been applying design thinking and design methodologies to some of these challenges. We also researched all different kinds of programs all over the world. Some were like MindLab that were operating in Denmark. Others were consultancies like Participle or IDEO. And we tried to pull out what we thought were some of the common ingredients and then hired Yuri to design our own lab. So the kind of challenges that I just mentioned, the chronic disease prevention, social housing, support for persons with disabilities, are the three challenges we're looking at now. So we're just really working with folks to redefine, quote unquote, the problem statement, to say that the kind of thing that we bring here is, yes, a design methodology, but also coming at things from an asset-based approach and not a negative deficit-based approach, and really engaging new thinkers to come around this. So it's early days, but it's very exciting, and I'm really looking forward to working with them as they tackle some of these challenges.
Tell me a little bit about what design thinking is and what you're doing with it.
In the world of design thinking, what we've done is try to engage the brains of what we're calling the creative. So think about architects or designers or other kinds of folks who are very creative, and that's how they make their living. But what they're used to doing is designing prototypes or things. But taking that brilliance and applying it to complex social challenges has been a really wonderful experience for us. So in addition to getting those folks in a room, we're also engaging entrepreneurs or those with an entrepreneurial mindset and who are into this lean startup kind of approach. So by marrying all of these things, we can say a prototype is great, but how do we correct? How do we learn early? How do we fail fast? All of that stuff to begin to design approaches to tackling complex challenges with all these different brains. But what excites me the most is that in the research that we did, we found that some of these solutions labs or change labs exist in government, some exist in consultancies, but none of them were based in the same way we're hoping to set this up, which is in a neutral nonprofit with early stage engagement of the government, who in this case is going to implement the solutions, and the entrepreneurs in a way that's going to allow for their innovations to come in as potential solution providers. So it's all very, very messy and wonderful, and we'll see what happens.
It's bringing up so many different things for me. I don't even know what to ask you first. So you've stymied me already. You talked a little bit earlier about changemakers allowing themselves to be vulnerable. You're talking about this sense of exploration, which when you're telling people you can't have the answer, you're right. That is saying you have to be vulnerable. And you guys are really upfront about confessing that you don't have the answer. You, in some parts, it sounds like, are really first seeking what the questions even are. And what's coming up for me is that you guys are really willing to be that sort of neutral, safe space for that exploration. And we don't talk a lot about that.
I think it's critical. I think it's really critical. And I think you're right. We don't have enough of those safe places. And so what we've been able to do is bring some government funding to the table, but we've been able to leverage it tenfold with philanthropy. And we've got other folks who are engaged, who are sponsoring different initiatives. And these are all really risk-taking kind of folks, not normally what you hear about government, but because we're buffering them, they can't take those kind of chances within government, and yet they know they have to. So that's been a very interesting approach.
Tell me about the buffering. What does that look like?
So what we say to government is, you know, we think that you guys are great and we think there's lots of wonderful intrapreneurs, but you're stymied. Like, for example, the slightest little thing about an approach has to go up several levels to get approval. And so we kept saying to them, you know what, today you're working for us and we don't have to get levels of approval. We're just going to run with it. And you don't actually have to take it up because we've got permission from your higher ups that that's how this is going to work. And it is so liberating and freeing for people who are very creative and yet are stymied by some of the bureaucracies.
Isn't that interesting? If you think about that, now I'm translating that because you guys are working with top levels of government and with folks who can make decisions but need permission. The same thing happens with tiny grassroots organizations when they're coming together at the table and the first thing they say is, well, I don't have my board's approval. And that's really fascinating to think about. You're really thinking about it systemically of what will it take for those people to feel safe?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all of that. And I was actually just thinking the other day, so having run nonprofits for about 30 years, there was organizational change that happened within the particular nonprofit, which was great. But we quickly figured out that if we wanted to have some real influence, we needed to network, we needed to form these coalitions. And that's terrific as well. But where I'm resting now is that we actually need to gather new partners. We need to engage those unusual stakeholders for transformative change. That's the only way we're going to get to something, I believe, at a really different system level. None of us can do it alone. It's not the for-profit, nonprofit, charitable, government sector, even academics have the answer. But together, we have a shot at it.
Oh, man. What else are you finding? Because really, Mars is all about exploration. You're about bringing people together and the magic that happens when people come together, because we are, just as you said, way more brilliant together than we are separately. What else are you finding allows people to feel safe, to be vulnerable, to explore?
I really have come to embrace the term enlightened self-interest, because I think it's okay for someone to come to the table and say, listen, this is what my objectives are, what I need to do, or what I think is the right thing to do, to put it out on the table in such a way that we can figure out how to work together. If I go back to my 2-1-1 days, I was running a relatively small grassroots organization, and I needed, for example, in this case, the United Way, with their amazing connections to the telcos or the big telecom providers, because I had to get this through the regulatory requirements, mm-hmm. which was made in CRTC, FCC, I guess, in the U.S. And I didn't have those kind of connections. They did. And then I needed someone to fund another part of it. And right now, at that stage, the federal government was working on getting databases online. So that was a great opportunity. So they held the part of it that was about the online database. And United Way held the corporate connections. And then the City of Toronto held the person that actually answers the phone around this. So we found out ways that everybody could really look good to their own constituencies, but together we had a grander vision that we were all a part of. That I thought was great. I mean, stop pretending that you don't have some self-interest here. Like, altruism is wonderful, but let's be really honest with each other about how we're going to really make this advance. And I think that helps accelerate change.
It's really different from that traditional, it's been 20 years or so, where funders are requiring people to collaborate. If you want to get funded by a foundation, if you don't have a collaboration, you're going to be looked at less favorably. And we've always sort of joked that that just makes larger groups of people compete with each other rather than one-on-one competing, just larger groups are competing. But people come together for expediency in those cases. We need to have 3 people on the grant, so we'll sign it. And you get all that power language of who's going to lead this and who's going to be in charge. It's a very, very different model than everyone coming out of it with something amazing. That I loved what you said, that they all get to look good to their constituencies. That's a very different approach.
It's a very different approach. And I agree with you. I've been in many of those, which almost came down to, can you just please sign right here and say you'll be part of this collaborative? Okay, right? You know, sort of, well, okay, will you do it for mine? I mean, that it can get to that point of lunacy. I think this is a much more honest approach. And I have found that, you know, funders are willing to engage with us in that kind of conversation. I think it's also really important to start with where people are. I will give you a quick story about integrating social innovation into Mars. Now, everybody here speaks a different language, be that the language of science or research or business or you name it, entrepreneurship. There's a lot of different languages. You need like a universal translator in the elevator to understand each other. But what struck me was there was an opportunity to look at a particular venture. It was called Bitstrips. And Bitstrips was an organization that, where they were cartoonists and they developed a better way to do animation. And they came into Mars and they were simply looking to commercialize. So you can imagine perhaps Disney or Pixar, or one of those groups with their intended audience for a prospective buyout in the future.
Okay.
But because they were doing this kind of innovative creating avatar things, and because we look at things also through a social impact lens, we thought maybe there's an opportunity here for these guys to work in schools. And they said, well, tell us what you're thinking about. And we said, we don't really know, but let's play with this a bit. And sure enough, they went to the school board. The school board loved it. We matched it to curriculum. And what we were finding is kids started to do things like tell stories using this Bitstrips animation about being bullied.
Wow.
It was a freeing, very comfortable way for kids to express themselves. And so now the school boards in Ontario do bullying competitions using Bitstrips that has unbelievable participation. And this is a very unintended consequence. What else is happening? Oh, boys' literacy rates are beginning to improve, and girls as well, but in particular boys, because they're taking risks and they're writing in a freeing kind of way. So they were able to get huge new market opportunities, the education system, and they were able to have these unintended social consequences. And that was a turning point for me at Mars when people said, oh, she's not just this flaky kind of socially person. She's actually able to open up new market opportunities for our clients and look at the social stuff. That's great. We as people love that and love that that can happen. But bringing those two together was a turning point for me at Mars.
Wow. That is such a fabulous story.
And I think there are other kinds of stories. In fact, we had a cluster of really cool innovations in the education space that came in through me. Then we had a very cool cluster of innovations in the education space that came in through the technology group, which is you meet people where they're at. And then once you bring them in, you say, okay, Jump Math, who's got this very interesting way to create a numerate society by teaching kids you don't have to have a math gene. That's actually nonsense. And we can teach you math against someone who's coming in from a technology point of view and get them to think about their social impact. You can bring these groups together into a cluster where they learn from each other and they recognize we're all looking to have a better education system, a more impactful system, and we can actually generate income through sales to different boards or ministries of education or whatever it is that achieves this double or triple bottom line.
What you're talking about really comes back to that nugget of you create a safe environment where people who never had thought, so if we're talking about Bitstrips, they weren't thinking about schools, they were thinking about Disney, they were thinking about Pixar, they were thinking about scaling. You created an environment that met them where they were, with what they thought they needed. We're going to talk markets in a language that they thought they needed. We're going to talk markets. We're going to talk expansion. We're going to talk scale. But you opened the door to what's possible in a way that was very non-threatening and brought possibility into the conversation rather than here's the six things we do. Having that open possibility creates the weird thing. So many people think that having that open spread of anything is possible is intimidating, but what it's really doing, it's giving you this huge spice rack from which to pull your spices to add to the stew.
Exactly. And I really think, and this is one of my big things in life, I want people to bring their whole self to whatever it is that they're doing. So yes, they want to make money, but they are also fathers or sons or brothers or neighbors, and they want the best for their children and they want the best for their community. And so if I can get people to bring their whole self to that, which is minimally both economically and socially, then it makes people better. And when I mean by better, I mean like they're happier and they are able to be more sustainable in their approach and their thinking, and sustainable both financially and environmentally. It just gets people thinking differently. And that's what I want. I want people to bring their whole self to this work.
It moves us beyond when we got into the industrial age. We had to act as if we were the same automatons as the machines were. Everybody was pigeonholed. You wore your suit. You went to work and your personal life was your personal life and you didn't bring it to work. The information age really is changing all of that. It really is being an age of connectedness. You can't just connect with one part of you. I hear more conversations going on in social media just about everywhere where people are asking, where do you draw the line in terms of what to share? because it feels so natural to share so much. And you're right, that's where the joy is. And when that joy is there, we're more productive.
Right. Hildy, under your guidance and your leadership, you started this conversation with tell us about your meandering journey. And that's who I am. I didn't, you know, start off by saying, here's where I worked. I told you, and I thought a lot about, you know, how much do I share, as you just said. But this is the story of me, that the realization that I have about how as an immigrant kid, not a visible minority, but certainly an immigrant kid, that changes how I interact in the world. And I think that's all really important for us to think about ourselves that way and to help understand how that got us to where we are.
You and I had the opportunity to meet when I was in Toronto, and we facilitated several sessions, including one at Mars. And I believe it may have been the session at Mars at the end when folks were reflecting on what had stood out for them, that someone, I captured this phrase and I think I'll take it with me always, said, we need to acknowledge that our vulnerabilities are our greatest strength. And I so appreciate your sharing your stories, your insights, your observations with us today. I could talk to you for 2 hours and never get bored and just want more. So what I would love to be able to do is in a year or two, as your stories unfold at Mars, I'd love to be able to check back with you and see what's going on and see what you guys have been learning. So thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It was wonderful to chat with you as always.
Listening to Allison, it's clear that she's describing the heart and soul of what it takes to create a culture of innovation for an organization, for a government department, for a business, and for our communities. Allison's experience, not just at Mars, but throughout her professional and her personal life, shows two interconnected paths to creating that culture. The first is the path of open possibility. I loved how Allison phrased the invitation that was offered to the province of Ontario to join Mars's Solutions Lab, a complex challenge they had tried to address but still felt stuck, a sticky problem that could benefit from multi-sectoral engagement where they couldn't already know or even think they knew the answer. Talk about an invitation to possibility. And it's no surprise that the results from that spirit of possibility are like the results Mars found with Bitstrips, an app that allows you to create comics you can star in. The school's openness to experiment with that app led to kids telling their own stories about being bullied, and that led to an increase in boys' literacy rates. When we're open to creating favorable conditions for possibility to emerge, the sky really is the limit. But just being open to possibility isn't enough, as Allison made clear as she talked about the need for a neutral, safe space for exploration. If part of being willing to explore is also being willing to open up, to be vulnerable, to be authentic about our motivations, and especially to be willing to fail, that neutral safe space is critical to our being willing to reach for what's possible in the first place. Which leads to questions for your own work. What would it take to have a culture of innovation permeate your work? What would your organization need to have in order for that spirit of open possibility to be your day-to-day expectation of how things are done? What would you and the leaders of your organization need to believe for that culture of innovation and possibility to be just how we do things? To help facilitate that culture of innovation and possibility, what does your organization do to be a safe space for the kinds of exploration Allison talked about? Is your organization a place where it's okay to be vulnerable with each other, where it's okay to fail? And if not, what would need to be in place for that feeling of safe space to be present in your own day-to-day? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hildy Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hildy Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.